an absolute pleasure to be with you this evening. You do have, I think, the handout, so you can at least mark your progress through the evening. And if you do think, how much longer can this guy talk for? You can at least tick off the bullet points as we go, and it maybe won't be quite so bad. All things bright and beautiful, living in the face of nature's indifference to humanity. About 3 weeks ago, I was skiing in the French Alps, one of the most beautiful ski weeks I've had. Sunshine, blue skies, some of the most stunning scenery you can imagine. And if you're given to finding God in nature, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better place to encounter the divine. However, as much as I might have enjoyed the sense of reveling in God's world on the ski slopes, I can't ignore the reality of other occasions when nature is neither enjoyable nor benevolent. To list just a few of those: 24th of August, 79 AD, Pompeii in Italy, Mount Vesuvius erupted, burying 11,000 people. 30th of June, 1908, in Tunguska in Russia, a meteor impact felling over 8 million trees across an area of 800 square miles, crashed to ground. In living memory, on the 18th of May, 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted in terrifying technicolor and helped us realize that we live on top of a volatile planet. Boxing Day 2004, the relentless invasion of a tsunami in Thailand and Indonesia killed over 250,000 people. If we want to shift to the macro, from the macro to the micro, much of last year's news was dominated by the encroachment of the Ebola virus in its latest mutation. Its march across Sierra Leone and Liberia and Guinea left 10,000 dead, and the Western world terrified that the virus might yet cross into our population here. And of course, the news today reinforces this again. Catherine Clancy's paintings around the walls here tonight highlight aspects of that natural world, particularly the seascapes on this side here. They seem to me to portray both nature's beauty and its untamable, wilder edge. We might say its indifference to us as a species. And when we think about suffering, we often discuss the effects of human beings' cruelty to each other. In fact, our daily news is full of it. And we might despair at the level of senseless violence that we are capable of inflicting upon each other, what we call human evil. We might agree that this is the outcome of humanity having the freedom to choose our actions and the course of our lives, and not everyone chooses well. The natural world, however, is often seen as benign. The planet that produces our food, the sun that warms us on our summer holidays, yet for all of nature's beauty, for every shimmering sunset, there's a destructive act, a violent event in which nature eliminates all in its path. This reality might serve as a reminder that we are vulnerable and fragile. We can be crushed by nature's activity as easily as being nourished by it. This reality might also serve to challenge us at a deeper level, causing us to question the nature of God, or even our faith in that God. So let's think about theodicy and suffering. Here's the nub of the issue that I want to explore over the next few minutes. It's a parallel query to the classic theodicy question. And theodicy asks us to justify the existence of God in the face of the existence of evil. The paradox is set thus. If God is both omnipotent and loving, how can evil exist? If God is all-powerful, then he could prevent the existence of evil. But since he evidently chooses not to, he cannot be a loving God. Similarly, if God really is loving, he would prevent evil's existence. So perhaps he wants to, but is powerless to prevent it. Therefore, God cannot be deemed omnipotent. In addressing this dilemma, it requires us to be careful about what we mean by the words all-powerful or omnipotent. The equation of the word power with prevention is misleading. Love does not necessarily mean control. The kind of love that is so powerful that it allows the other freedom to become fully human and to come to a place of loving without coercion is, of course, fraught with risk. And if it's God's love that we are talking about, it will have within it the freedom that allows the creature space to also become creative. Allowing the other to create and to become is laced with opportunity, both positive and negative. Primarily, it requires the risky process of withdrawing from control of the other, of making room for their existence. This cannot be equated with powerlessness or impotence, but crucially, it springs from the choice to give to the other the gift of human autonomy. In this case, the decision to withhold the power to control is a demonstration of power in itself. So as we reflect on the existence of evil, we recognize that it emerges from human activity, the outcome of the freedom to choose. It has the corollary of kindness, compassionate action, creativity, and love. For these too are products of human autonomy. We might say that in order for humanity to exist in loving freedom, God must withhold God's power, or all would be God. So, living in the face of nature's indifference. I said that the issue we will be thinking about is parallel to theodicy, so let's move beyond that now. In some ways, our question is a more troubling one. That is the issue of loving God in the face of a world that is indifferent to us. For alongside the wonder of a natural world and the beauty that is so evident is the reality that we suffer. We are subject to accidents, illness, and destruction. Our loved ones contract diseases. We are victims of misfortune. Our homes are destroyed in the winter floods. Few of us get through life without knowing misery in some form. Despite loving and serving God, things still go wrong. We know that bad things happen to good people. And facing the harshness of nature's laws, few would be content to use the phrase natural evil, for this implies some moral intent. And we know that the erupting volcano has no intent to harm. It is simply following the laws of physics. And yet we must live in this marbled world where nature both sustains and crushes us. We say this is God's world, and the Christian faith claims to love, serve, and worship this God. How do we live, survive, and flourish in the face of nature's indifference? Against this background, what does loving and serving God mean when we are still subject to nature's indifference to our existence? What is the point if we receive no material benefit? Why do things still go wrong in a life that's dedicated to the God who holds all of the universe in the palm of his hand? And if this talk of benefit sounds too mercenary for you, why not use the language of miracle? Or even of prayer, if that is too extreme? Do we not expect God to effect or influence the natural world, the forces of nature, for our benefit? Surely when we pray, we expect God to do something. Whilst we might not admit to asking God to open up a parking space in Waitrose's car park on a busy Saturday afternoon, the genuine cry for God to make our lives better, easier, less painful, betrays our belief in an interventionist God, a God who can improve our lot in life. The relentless outworking of nature's laws throws the problem into sharp relief. How can we claim to truly love God if that love is predicated on an expectation of receiving benefit, some advantage or gain, some relief from nature's indifference to us? Love that expects benefit or favor is not love, but a contract, a deal or an exchange. And what do we think that we can offer God in return for his favor? Does God really need our love, our loyalty? And as for favoritism, does not God send the rain on the just and the unjust alike? So as we think about the indifference of the natural world to humanity, behind it lies a reservoir of issues concerning God as creator, humanity who loves and serves that God, and the reality of living with suffering. This is at the heart of our paradox. Whilst we might celebrate a sense of living in the hollow of the Creator's hand, we cannot avoid our own insignificance in that very world. The same physical laws that sustain us and hold us on the planet's surface can obliterate us in an instant. The same grand scale and majesty that inspires awe in us also reinforces our place as perhaps not being as dominant as we might like to think. Earlier, relating to human free will, I stated that God must withhold God's power or all would be God. This is a quotation from Simone Weil, someone who had an interest in nature's indifference to humanity, which she called the necessity of nature. She was born of wealthy Jewish parents in Paris in 1909. A brilliant student with a love of classical literature, mathematics, and philosophy. Her studies took her to the Sorbonne and eventually to become a school teacher. She had a passion for social justice that led her into controversy, thanks to a driven, almost obsessive personality. She devoted much of her time to educating oppressed factory workers, teaching them literacy skills, and trying to introduce the possibility of change in their world. She sought involvement in the Spanish Civil War, even though she considered herself a pacifist, and eventually she died, aged only 34, in Ashford in Kent, of cardiac failure, induced by eating only starvation rations in solidarity with the French people suffering in the grip of the Nazi regime. She may seem like an unlikely contributor to the discussion of how human suffering in the face of nature and Christian life might integrate. However, she had a lifelong concern about how humanity should engage with each other and with the universe, and later, as a convert to Christian faith, how we relate to God. In her writings, she recollects three occasions in which she had mystical encounters with the divine, and blends these with a rational and pragmatic approach to spirituality, having room for both the rational and the mystical, for contemplation and action. She was a paradoxical figure, and apparently not easy to live with. Yet she might provide some insights that might help us find a way to live and love God amongst the indifference of the world. And the rest of this talk this evening will explore some of her thinking. Simone's elder brother was a well-known mathematician, and she had quickly developed an appreciation for mathematics, particularly geometry. For Weil, the existence of abstract geometric forms that we can understand and manipulate became a means of explaining how we can grasp the existence of order behind nature. It was her desire that we learn to read the natural world correctly. It's a phrase she uses often, to read the natural world correctly. She gives the example of a cube. We can never see a cube in its entirety, and in fact, the faces we do see appear as non-square. Yet our minds have no difficulty in conceiving of a cube. We can understand that the form of a perfect cube exists, even though we see only an imperfect representation, as with all geometric shapes. So for example, the ideal triangle has lines with no width and perfect angles, but any attempt to draw one results in an inadequate representation. Connecting this, Vey argues that we can grasp that order exists behind the necessity of nature, arguing that what is perceived in the natural world is not a true picture. There is a hidden reality which, if glimpsed, can in turn enlighten our perceived reality. She notes that we experience the brute force of nature. It seems unlimited in its power and indifference to us. However, just as we recognize the concept of limit in geometric ratios and proportions, and thus observe in the apparently unlimited an obedience to limit, nature's order obeys limits too. In its laws, cycles, and proportion exists an order imposed by God. For, she says, what is sovereign in this world is determinateness and limit. So, immaterial or abstract concepts that exist in the mind are the arena in which we can embrace the knowledge that God is the reality whom the universe obeys. She believed that abstract thought has the power to facilitate progress in the material world. In particular, that reflective thought is the means of attaining liberty within the confines of nature's necessity that impinges upon us. And this parallels her belief that this applies in the political and social realm too. She was deeply concerned about human oppression of others. For in the same way that nature impinges on us, societal structures and injustice can do so too. The regime that concerned her most was the type of oppressive work caused by the division of labor found within the production line factories that she worked in. When facing this type of oppression, she felt that it was the overwhelming scale of the oppression that made the individual seem minuscule and powerless to affect change. Here, she suggests the possibility of turning away from the oppressive force as a means of finding some degree of liberty. For example, she says, if I want to knock down a wall, there is little point standing before it, pounding with my fists or pushing as hard as I can, because nothing will change. The most effective means is to leave the wall, go away and find a sledgehammer, and then return to demolish it. So the power to overcome a constraint by initially turning away from it and making room to construct an abstract solution is necessary. I want to say more about oppression in a few moments, but first, we need to remain focused on the suffering caused by nature. So we think now about the abdication of power. We have considered Vey's interest in the necessity of nature, her way of describing the actuality of living among the natural world's indifference to humanity. Nature provides a distance between God and us, and it is precisely this distance that accommodates our autonomy. She succinctly states, necessity is the screen set between God and us so that we can be. God as creator does not exercise his power everywhere. He chooses in the act of creation to enable a reality other than himself to exist. Thus, God renounces his place as sole reality in the universe. The act of creation itself is an act of unconditional love. For, and again I quote from Vey, by concentrating on an expenditure of energy which will not extend his own power, but will only give existence to a being other than himself, who will exist independently of him, God brings us into existence. God makes no demands upon his creatures, but allows them simply to exist and gives them space to flourish. She states, because he is the creator, God is not all-powerful. Creation is abdication. But he is all-powerful in this sense, that his abdication is voluntary. He knows its effects and wills them. So God allows the universe to operate under two laws, the necessity of nature and human autonomy. Nature's necessity means its blind obedience to God's natural laws. This provides the possibility of human autonomy. Now, there are echoes here of the notion of Tzimtzum from Judaism's Lurianic Kabbalah, the mystical writings, in that the withdrawal of God's essence makes space for creation. It allows the created order to begin. Yet, thinking about withdrawal, we should not confuse these propositions with Pascal's Deus Absconditus, for those of you who know that way of thinking. It contains a sense of negativity and despair at God's hiddenness in the trials of life. But Vey does not suggest that God merely turns his back on humanity, but that he is a captivated and absorbed sustainer who by choice does not exercise his power everywhere as he could. In order for autonomy to be genuine, God must be seen to be absent, she says. For if God were not absent, all would be God. In this way, humanity can freely consent to loving God. So, the necessity of nature. The purpose of God's absence is that human love of God can be disinterested love, a love of God for who God is, rather than for the material benefits or blessings that might accrue from loving the Creator. Love of God in order to attain an ensuing blessing would not be pure love. It would be corrupted by acquisitive motivations. Nature's indifference ensures that all experience the blessings and hardships of the natural world, regardless of status. And Vey points out that nature is obedient to God's order. In fact, this obedience is nature's beauty. It is, of course, easy to appreciate nature's aesthetic beauty while watching a sunrise, but what happens when nature's necessity hurts us and we suffer through that hardship? It is at such times that we no longer see the beauty of nature, for when it impinges on us, we feel wronged, although nature is indifferent to us, and its actions cannot be said to be evil. She says, "Joy and suffering are two equally precious gifts, which must both of them be savored to the full, each one in its purity, without trying to mix them. Through joy, the beauty of the world penetrates our soul. Through suffering, it penetrates our body. We could no more become friends of God by joy alone than become a ship's captain by studying books on navigation. The body plays a part in all apprenticeships." So, in the face of nature's indifference, learning comes in a momentary opportunity that Vey calls hesitation, where we are able to pause as we ask the question, "Why is this happening to me?" In this moment of opportunity, we can give attention to our suffering and try to discover what motivated this initial self-centered response. Why me? We must, like Job, learn to accept the necessity of nature, embrace its indifference, and thus begin to see our place in the universe. How we can do this in the face of suffering, and even under the affliction caused by human cruelty, is something Vey explores in some depth. She makes no room for self-aggrandizement in suffering, and allows no room for seeing the self as gaining any favor by believing in God, as this passage illustrates. "If I thought that God sent me suffering by an act of his will and for my good, I should think that I was something, and I should miss the chief use of suffering, which is to teach me that I am nothing. It is therefore essential to avoid all such thoughts. But it is necessary to love God through the suffering." Now, we might hear in this passage negation of self, and perhaps evidence of a martyr complex. But this would be to miss the connection that she makes with the incarnation. The self-emptying that characterized the life and death of Christ was evident in his passivity in the face of impending death. In the laying aside of his own will, Christ becomes the meeting place of humanity and divinity. It is not an issue of self-esteem, but of service. I'll return to the notion of suffering as a place of intersection shortly, but first I want to spend a moment thinking about how we might face suffering in the face of nature's indifference. So we turn to think about suffering and affliction. They, despite her privileged background, knew what suffering was. She was beset by ill health throughout her short life. But it was a particular kind of suffering that absorbed her interest. The suffering caused by social oppression, by overwhelming cruelty, which she calls affliction. Suffering is the crushing caused by nature's indifference to us. Affliction is the destructive oppression caused by social necessity. The injustice of humanity oppressing each other is not a method of teaching, unlike nature's necessity. The natural world has no malice in creating the hardship that it does. So we are never degraded by the suffering caused by it. And they would, perhaps rather romantically, have us see this hardship as being like the pain in the powerful handshake of a long-lost friend. She has been accused of being masochistically obsessed with suffering as the only means of finding God. However, she is careful to balance this view of suffering by acknowledging that pure, unmixed joy is also an effective means of enlightenment, though she is aware that this might just be a remote possibility for many. This brings us to think about how to read nature correctly. Simone Weil's criteria for experiencing God were quite pragmatic. She did not view mystical experiences as proof of God, but rather as supplements to faith, love, and reason. And she placed considerable emphasis on the latter. She was acutely aware that similar experiences can be read differently by different people, she states. Two women each receive a letter announcing to each that her son is dead. The one faints at her first glance at the paper, and never again until she dies will her eyes, her mouth, her movements be as they were. The second remains the same. Her look, her bearing does not change. She does not know how to read. So as we can learn to read life events, so we can learn to read suffering and even affliction correctly. When faced with an oppressive situation, she advocated turning away to consider an abstract solution that could later be applied to ease the situation, if not solve it. However, she acknowledges that affliction can just as easily crush a person. There is no guarantee that progress can be made. And in extreme cases, perhaps the best that can be hoped for would be to, and I quote, introduce some play in the cogwheels of the machine that so ruthlessly crushes them. So in suffering and affliction, a person ideally makes a choice. They can accept their pain and sense of desolation and use it as a lever to lift them to a higher plane of awareness and love of God. This seems at first an unlikely way forward, and she admits that not everyone can do it. However, the acceptance of one's situation is a cry of dereliction in which the self is decreated, and the desire to obey and accept God's will becomes everything. In this cry of dereliction, of course, is the danger that the alienation felt from God will be permanent, and one will be crushed, never recovering from that abandonment. And in this, she consistently returns to the idea that the thing separating us from God is the thing that brings us to God. I quote, Two prisoners whose cells adjoin communicate with each other by knocking on the wall. The wall is the thing which separates them, but it is also their means of communication. It is the same with us and God. Every separation is a link. So, Simone Weil reckons that nothing can truly separate us from God, for even affliction can be overcome by reaching out to God in it. This, she calls, an orientation of oneself towards God, a turning of one's face towards the good. And here is a refusal to lose the capacity to love. And it requires hesitation, a concept which we'll talk about in a moment. Hesitation, reflection, and rational thought, things that may not be possible for all in extreme circumstances. In the degradation caused by affliction, the person is being destroyed. They have no choice and no voice, being treated as a thing, their autonomy stifled. In this case, the worst outcome is that the expectation of good or the capacity to love will be destroyed, for this is the sacred part of a person. Let's move on to think about hesitation and giving attention, one of her key points. In surviving suffering under nature's necessity and reading nature correctly, hesitation is a key word for her. It underpins much of her work on relationships, both with God and with each other. Now, hesitation is not an uncertain dithering when certain action is required, but an unusual response that breaks the pattern of normal human behaviour. Hesitation is a pause, a moment in which we refuse to respond instantly and with anger. It is a moment of opportunity, of reflection, a moment of opening ourselves up to another possibility. It is the doorway into the key moment of giving attention. She notes that the normal human response to nature's necessity impinging on our life is to be hostile, and this response can only be overcome by grace, providing access to a higher reading of nature, a view of the world from a different perspective. So what does a correct reading of nature reveal? For Weil, we are in an apprenticeship, constantly seeking to overcome our reaction against nature's necessity. We are to learn that the pain and suffering we experience are all aspects of necessity that must be accepted and perhaps even loved. We are to become indifferent to the medium and find the meaning behind it. Such understanding is born of hesitation and comes through giving attention to God in our suffering. The correct reading suspends complaints about injured rights in favor of supernatural insight. She gives the illustration of a blind person using a stick to guide themselves along the road. What they feel is the unevenness of the ground, the shape of the world mediated by that stick. For them, it is not the stick that is of interest, but the world mediated by it. So it is with reading the world in which we live. We are to discover the supernatural behind the natural realm in which we move. And hesitation is an opportunity. We must not ignore it, but attend to it, so that as we develop and change our perspective on the world, we align ourselves more closely with the divine pattern. This pattern, as we have seen, is that of renouncing power, of allowing others to exist without our control, thus giving them the gift of autonomy. This provides them the opportunity of freely consenting to God and to us. So, facing nature's necessity, we do not seek to avoid it or rail at its injustice. We seek to find the divine pattern or limit behind it. This divine way of seeing the world is to recognize the unity of all nature, the order that it obeys, and our place within its structure. We can then freely consent to its necessity. This initiates decreation of the self, which for Ve is the route to fulfillment. Only hesitation in the face of the natural desire for self-preservation could enable us to say, and I quote, "No matter what happens to us, we can give thanks for the order of the universe, our power to perceive its order, and our power to yield even our lives to it. Although it takes great courage and nobility to bear our own destruction, it is that very capacity which gives us dignity." Well, this way of being was most fully illustrated in the incarnation, in consent to a higher reality. Suffering and even death in obedience to this reality did not bring Christ's destruction, but his glory. And that leads us very nicely to think about the suffering God. It's worth noting Christ's free consent to suffering for a moment. His was not suffering under the necessity of nature, it was affliction under human cruelty. Yet the principle demonstrated is transferable, for the incarnation provides a pattern of the divine renunciation of power. On the cross, Christ does not succumb to the temptation to lose his capacity for love. He cries out in his abandonment, but by an act of will, keeps his face orientated towards his Father. Christ never lost the expectation of good and remained able to love under torture, abandonment, and alienation. In this, he retained his true humanity and did not allow affliction to corrode his soul. At the crucifixion, the greatest possible distance existed between Father and Son. Yet, as Ve points out, distance is separation only for those who are in a love relationship. She argues that lovers desire two things: to be so close as to be united as one, and to be so in love as to be unaffected by the greatest distance. Christ's cry of dereliction is evidence of the love of God, and the suffering Christ becomes an intersection of love and affliction. In this description, I am reminded of Karol Bialok, tortured during political imprisonment in Chile, 1975. She maintained that the only way of surviving was by, I quote, "learning to breathe underwater, by doing the impossible, by maintaining the capacity to love when all her horrific circumstances required that she abandon it." Similarly, Ve maintains that in the meeting of love and affliction, the screen that separates God and humanity is pierced. However, it would be unfair to suggest that this is the only way that she conceived of initiating relationship with God. Through love and friendship, the struggle for justice, fulfilling work, and a host of other occupations, we do encounter God. She acknowledges the marbling of good and evil within humanity and outlines the vigilance necessary to will belief in the good over evil. You'd be pleased to hear that we are drawing towards the end. If you're ticking off your bullet points, we're now going to return to think about loving God and others. So let's return to the initial question that I set in the introduction. What does it mean to love God if that love brings no material benefits to us? We know that God loves us, and Ve suggests this divine love that crosses the infinite separation between humanity and God can be reciprocated by finite creatures. It is not only in suffering or affliction that this takes place, lest we think that, in Ve's rather bleak world, this is the only arena for divine encounter. If, even in affliction, the most unlikely place it is possible to love God, then there must be a multitude of other ways too. The apogee of love of God is exhibited in disinterested love, love without acquisitive desire. We must love God for who God is, and not for what we can get out of that relationship. So our love for others and for God is to be modelled on this principle of abdication of power, the renunciation of coercion or command. This, they suggest, can be the only form of pure love. Relating to God, we renounce the desire to control God in prayer, to command and coerce. Relating to others, we refuse to treat them as an object, utilizing or coercing in order to fulfill our desires. Pure love is revealed in our reflecting God's creative act. We are accorded the ability to freely consent, and we extend to the other this same gift. Love, as demonstrated by God, is seen in the sometimes painful gift of giving the other the room to flourish, although they may not reciprocate. The other may choose an unexpected life course, and our temptation is to stifle their autonomy by exerting pressure to bring them back. But pure love is exhibited in that each must renounce the desire to control the other and give enough distance to permit autonomy. For she states, "There is not friendship where distance is not kept and respected." And here she identifies love's paradox of linking intimacy and separation. In conclusion, we began this exploration in the arena of nature's indifference to humanity. In our scientifically advanced age, we understand to a significant degree how the natural world works and are increasingly in control of natural processes. We understand how the human body operates and how to repair it when things go wrong. So we are becoming used to controlling our natural environment, our health, our future existence. However, this knowledge, power, and skillful operation bring associated problems. We can be seduced into believing that we are in control of everything and can fix everything. Most recently, this was discussed by Atul Gulwandi's Reef Lectures, where he focused on the medicalization of death, where death is seen as an enemy that can be defeated if we can just throw enough resources at it. We are conditioned to see death as a defeat, an insult, which could have been avoided if only enough investment had been made. But returning to the big picture, the natural world on occasion crushes us. Those who encounter the untamable fury of nature know what danger lies there. From the mountain climber who gets caught in a freak storm, to the fisherman whose boat is swamped by an overwhelming wave, nature is still too big for us. Our human advances, if not our arrogance, can encourage us to forget that we are always ants under nature's heel. And we become very adept at insulating ourselves from this reality and feel aggrieved when we're crushed by it. It is precisely this desire to insulate ourselves from nature that they identify as being at the root of our problem. Our refusal to accept our place in the universe and to recognize that God, the Creator, is as present in the suffering as he is in the celebration of ease, blessing, and comfort. But I want to conclude properly now with a question, and it's one I hope has been bubbling away in your mind since my introduction. Is there a place for the miraculous, or does Simone Weil advocate a mechanistic universe in which God does not intervene. Well, ironically, I think her stance seems to me to return miracle to its rightful place, taking it out of the mundane, the providing a parking space realm, and into the highly unusual, truly supernatural and inexplicable. The refusal to trivialize miracle and to allow the miraculous to be a divine intervention rather than a human get out of jail card to be played, or should I say prayed, at our convenience, seems to me to be heading in the right direction.